This is Colorado Matters from CPR News. I'm Ryan Warner. Dan Beard led the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation for 2 years under President Bill Clinton. He now believes the federal agency, best known for its massive Western water projects, should be abolished. Beard argues his case in a new book called Deadbeat Dams. He joins us from Washington, D.C., and thanks for being on the program.
Thank you very much, Ryan. I'm happy to be with you.
So the Bureau of Reclamation was founded more than a century ago. It's part of the U.S. Department of Interior. Why get rid of it now?
Why keep it? Okay. I think it's a very simple question. We have federal agencies to perform certain functions. And the question is, why do we have it? It was created to help the federal government assist local communities and states to build dams and reservoirs and canals across the West, and to help settle the West, and to help economic development. Well, they've done that job. And now the question remains, why should we keep them? And as I point out in the book, I go through a number of different reasons for keeping them, and I come up empty every time I keep asking the questions. It's a great agency with a proud history, and I was proud to be the commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation. But times and conditions change, and I think it's time that we allow leadership for solving Western water problems to reside with the individual states, communities, and regional entities that can do a better job than having the federal government step in.
And I should mention that Colorado right now is developing its own statewide water plan. It'll be the first such statewide plan for Colorado. As we said, the Bureau of Reclamation is probably best known for its dam projects, hundreds of them throughout the West, including Hoover Dam, of course, but many smaller ones in Colorado. And your book is called Deadbeat Dams. What do you mean by that?
Well, a deadbeat is somebody who deliberately avoids paying their bills. And I think the beneficiary of federal projects have deliberately avoided paying their bills, paying for the facilities that were built for them. And they've pawned the bill off onto the taxpayers. And I think it's a little bit strong, but deadbeats still control Western water policy. And I think that their grip on the water policy faucet ought to be loosened. And we ought to move forward with solving problems ourselves instead of letting a small minority of people who are benefiting from a federal program control things.
Yeah. Who are those people that I think you refer to as the water nobility?
Well, it's very simple. People who are receiving water from federal dams across the West. It was intended that they would pay for these facilities, and yet they haven't. In fact, they have shuttled the bill off onto somebody else. But more importantly, about 20 years ago, those that receive water from federal facilities, I think originally thought that they were grateful that the federal government had provided them this service and this water and these resources. But about 20 years ago, a change took place, and the change was they began to, these recipients of federal water began to expect that the water and the money that was flowing to them was an entitlement, that they deserve to keep it in perpetuity.
Doesn't that make me water nobility and everyone listening in Colorado? Is that who you're talking about?
No, not necessarily. What I'm talking primarily about is agriculture. We heavily subsidize the delivery of water to agricultural interests in the West from federal facilities. What do I mean by that? I mean that it costs us $100 to deliver an acre foot of water, and we charge the farmers $2. Well, who picks up the other $98? And the answer is, it's you and me. Generally, the water that is delivered to communities throughout the West, throughout the nation, is not subsidized to the extent that it is for agriculture. So you're paying a higher price for water than agriculture certainly is.
Then what would you like the shift to be? So you talked about putting water management and planning more in the hands of people on the ground, local governments and states. Is it a question then of tearing down those facilities? Is it a question then of shifting the cost onto farmers? I can't imagine they'd be very happy about that. What is the change you're calling for in that respect with the water nobility?
The single most important change that we can make is to eliminate subsidized water. We will permanently alter the water world for the better if we do that. Policymakers at every level, and that means local, state, and federal level, have to begin to accept the principle that those who want to use a scarce resource like water should pay the full cost for that water. Those who need the water most will pay a price that reflects reality, if you will, and those who don't won't. I mean, it's that simple. We are delivering water at highly subsidized rates. The Congress is even afraid to calculate what the level of subsidy is for the Bureau of Reclamation program. The last time it was calculated was over 20 years ago. And the total program subsidy was $116 billion, which is sort of an astronomical number that's hard to describe. But what it means is that the taxpayers are taking out of their pockets money and handing it to a select set of interests, and we're doing so in perpetuity.
Is it that select, though? In other words, you could say, oh, look at farmers cashing in on this, but then they grow a tomato in California or a potato in Colorado, and I eat that. Is it as black and white as you're saying?
I think it's very black and white because most of the water used by agriculture, two-thirds of it is used for forage crops. It's not used for tomatoes. And that's one of the points that I go into in the book, this whole argument that it's we need to continue this level of subsidies to provide food and fiber for the nation is just – it's a fallacious argument. It's a silly argument because it just doesn't hold water, if you will. We need to eliminate – the subsidies involved in the delivery of water, and we need to get more realistic about how we use water, who uses it, and how much they pay for it. Once we start pricing water at anywhere near its real value, changes will take place. Yes, the crop mix will change. Some farmers will go out of business, but others will make more money. So there will be changes that will take place as you begin to price water somewhere near its real price.
And what would that mean for the water coming out of my tap or hose or dishwasher, you know?
It would be more expensive. But, it's very interesting in this country. We have, 320 million people in this country. And yet we all seem to perceive water in the same way, whether you're in Anchorage or Key West or Denver or Los Angeles. And that is that when we go to the tap, we can turn it and there will be an abundant supply of water, clean water, coming out of that tap, and it will be priced fairly low. It isn't going to be overly expensive. We've got to get rid of this notion that somehow we're going to have clean, abundant, and cheap water everywhere. Because it is not cheap to develop, transport, and deliver water. And the best lesson that you can see as to the value of water is just hold up a water bottle. Bottled water is now a $15 billion a year industry at the wholesale market. In 2017, it will overtake carbonated beverages. And we don't think twice about paying $1 or $2 or at the airport $3 for a bottle of water. I mean, this is something that we realistically accept. But somehow we walk around under the delusion that in our homes and on our fields, the water that we receive should be cheap and plentiful.
And I suppose then that connects with scarcity as well, because there's not a lot of water in the West, and yet there are increasingly more people. So when you look at the mega drought, which is what people are calling the situation in California, for instance, scarcity will be reflected in pricing, more so under what you envision, I gather.
Absolutely. And I think that it will lead to important changes. But I also think we need to puncture another myth or point out another myth, and that is that there isn't enough water. Frankly, every study that's undertaken shows that there is enough water. problem is it's just distributed incorrectly. And once you start pricing it, you will stop wasting it and sending it to grow forage crops to keep part-time farmers in business.
How does this connect, though, with the rather Byzantine set of laws around water in the West, of senior rights and junior rights and calls and, you know, even the notion of having a cistern and gathering a little bit of rainwater has been hugely controversial in Colorado. So is this realistic given the legal realities?
I think it's absolutely realistic because the legal systems that we have, and of course they're more confused and complicated in Colorado than any other state in the West, the legal system we have was a system built by and for the needs of agriculture and mining and the first settlers that arrived. And it's a great system if you're, just as long as you're not an environmentalist or an American Indian. If you're an Indian and you were there first, you lost. The water got stole from you. And so we've taken a lot of steps to try to compensate for those inequities. And our societal values with respect to leaving water in the river or in streams have changed. And as a result, we've gone through a number of complicated steps to make sure that we have sufficient amount of water to meet the needs of fisheries and tourism and other beneficial uses. So I think the legal system complicates things, but I don't think that it prevents us from moving ahead and making changes. We will make adjustments. You know, we have a lot of smart lawyers, a lot of smart politicians and activists, and we can work our way around these problems, and we can use other mechanisms such as taxation. I've always felt that if people receive a subsidy, for example, they should pay tax on it. I mean, it happens to individuals. If I give a gift to one of my children, which isn't going to happen anytime soon, but if I give a gift to my children and it exceeds a certain level, I have to pay tax on it. Well, why shouldn't we say that if you receive a subsidy in excess of a certain amount, you have to pay tax on that too? What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
You're listening to Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner, and we're speaking with Dan Beard, former commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. His new book, treatise, I suppose, is called Deadbeat Dams, Why We Should Abolish the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and Tear Down the Glen Canyon Dam. Let's talk about that latter aspect, Dan. Why, and is that even realistic? This is in Arizona. We should say northern Arizona.
Why keep it? I mean, when we have non-federal dams, we have a licensing process. Every dam has to go be relicensed every 50 or 75 years. But we don't do that with federal dams. Once we build them, somehow they're thought to be permanent features on the landscape. And the reality is they're not. They deteriorate with age. They fill with silt. And more importantly, the reasons why we built them evaporate. And I think that's the case in Glen Canyon Dam. We originally built it as part of a political compromise. There was a complicated set of negotiations led by Wayne Aspinall, a congressman from Western Colorado, dealing with upstream and downstream uses in the Colorado River. And about 12 people were basically in a room and cut a deal to decide that we build Glen Canyon Dam. Now, the question is, do we need it anymore? Is it adding value? And my point is, as I go through in the book, I point out the reasons why we built it no longer exist. So we should keep it just because it's always been there? I don't think so.
What are the give me the top two reasons that have kind of expired, in your opinion.
Well, first of all, it was built to store water. The reservoir is now 45% full, and water in the Colorado River Basin are in free fall, and the reservoir is not going to refill in our lifetime. More importantly, we have two half-empty reservoirs on the Colorado River, Lake Mead behind Hoover Dam near Las Vegas,
right,
and Lake Powell behind Glen Canyon Dam. I think what we ought to do is move the water behind Glen Canyon downstream and fill Lake Mead behind Hoover Dam. And in the process of doing that, we will restore the canyon that has been flooded for the last, parts of it have been flooded for the last 30 years. I think Glen Canyon is a magical place. I don't think we knew what we were doing at the time. I don't think we knew what we have covered up. And I think it's a tragedy that the dam still continues to exist.
Let me quote you from the book. I recognize, you write, the political infeasibility of draining Lake Powell and removing Glen Canyon Dam. But someone, you say, has to point out the obvious and begin advocating for sanity. And it makes me wonder what kind of reception you've gotten to the book. And if there's vitriol, perhaps?
Well, I haven't been to Page, Arizona to talk about the book yet. So the reception I've received in places like Colorado and Utah and others has been pretty interesting. And there is a constituency who does want to remove the dam and restore the canyon. I worked in the Congress and for different administrations in Washington, D.C. on natural resource matters for 30 years. I understand the politics. I understand that I'm out at the on the end of a limb, and it's pretty lonely out there right now. But the reality is that somewhere, sometimes, somebody has to begin to talk about these kinds of issues and raise these fundamental questions. And that was the whole reason I wrote the book. I could have written another water book. There's only about 50 million of them on the shelves. But I wanted to write a different book. I wanted to write a book that didn't pull punches and that tried to point out the flaws in the system. And more importantly, to point out ways that we can change the system to improve it.
Even the Bureau of Reclamation admits that the era of large dam construction is over. But rivers and canals cross state boundaries. Don't we need a federal agency to oversee water management in some respect?
We have 23 federal agencies that have water as one of their primary purposes, starting with EPA, the Department of Agriculture, the Soil Conservation Service, the Bonneville Power Administration. I can go down the list. The whole point is what we need more than anything is we need leadership. I have always felt that that should be the Bureau of Reclamation. But in the last decade, I've just become convinced that they will not do it. They won't. And so as a result, we ought to look somewhere else for leadership. And that somewhere else is the individual states. And I think the individual municipal water district, Denver Water is a good example, Southern Nevada Water Authority, the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, they have the expertise, they have the money, they have the ability to address problems.
We've just heard out of California that the governor wanted to save X percent of water, and boy, they didn't even come close. How do we know the states will do well with it?
Not this month, but give them time. They'll be able to do it. I mean, the reality is the governor isn't going to create any water in the state of California. Yes, he can order that there be reductions. But the delivery of water is a responsibility of the individual communities. They're on the front lines to be able to meet the challenges of the current drought, and they're the ones that are going to have to do so. It's the same thing in Denver with Denver Water. Denver Water is a terrific agency filled with talented people. I disagree with some of the things they want to do, but it doesn't matter. They're the ones that are going to have to ultimately deliver water and meet the needs of the residents of the areas they serve.
Dan, it's really fascinating. You've spoken to us about market forces, about eliminating a federal agency, about local control over federal control. When are you going to announce your candidacy for the Republican nomination?
Never. I've been a Democrat all my life, but it doesn't mean I have to be stupid about stuff and take positions that, you know, just don't make sense in the world. I think one of the most frustrating things to me about water is the lack of creativity that's been associated with the water world. In the water world, we seem to have put a dunce cap on, to just be perfectly honest about it. It is the most uncreative field that I can think of. I mean, we've sent men to the moon, put cell phones in the hands of billions of people across the globe, and yet the primary things that we're using to deliver water are surface storage and gravity. you know, at some point, we're going to wake up and begin to adapt new technology and new tools and new ideas to the delivery of water. And I think the key to that is going to be when it's priced correctly. Once people with, you know, that are innovative and creative realize that they can make money by coming up with new ideas, new approaches, new ways to meet our water needs, then we will unleash some creative forces that will begin to make a difference. Right now, as long as water is priced virtually as nothing, you know, it's practically free in some cases. In many cases, we pay people to take it. If that's the case, then there really isn't any incentive for creativity to enter into the system.
Aren't you just the Dr. Seuss's Lorax of water? you know, just to remind people that, you know, this is the story of a character who comes in and started selling air when air got precious. You could potentially be painting a very, like, scary picture in which only people who can afford it can have water. I mean, talk to the fears people might have there.
Well, I don't think people should have any fear at all. I mean, right now, you know, the individual consumer, they pay for their water. But yet we're delivering our most important resource at rock bottom rates to the largest users of water. In every state, the statistics are about the same. 80% of the consumptive use of water takes place in agriculture. So 8 out of every 10 gallons goes to agriculture. And agriculture has improved the efficiency with which it's using water in the last 20 years, but it still wastes water on a monumental scale. And what we need to do is price water differently so that we will use less of it.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, it was a great opportunity. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Daniel Beard, who led the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation under President Clinton, is author of Deadbeat Dams. You can read an excerpt at cprnews.org. The Bureau declined to respond to the book.